history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right in your midst that really need to be told, and we'll never hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today I'm in Modesto, California, home for the last 47 years, to Bill Koenig. He's originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan, a very different climate from Central California. We're going to hear about what he did with the 86th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. But let's start on in Grand Rapids. Growing up as a young boy and living through the Great Depression, did you have a concept of what was happening then? Did you notice any difference in those Depression years?
Yeah, the man next door was laid off, out of a job, and I can remember my folks hiring him. So he got a little money coming in to paint the bathroom. Then the road building started with Roosevelt. And so all of a sudden we got a new sewer down the street, and men doing all pick and shovel work in a shovel. So you got some new work coming through the place, kept people busy.
And it was you and your younger brother. How much younger?
4 years.
So you got to beat him up a little bit then.
Yes.
I appreciate your honesty. Most people say, "Nah, I didn't do that." Can you give us a sense of what life was like growing up? What kinds of things you did or the dreams you had?
It was a very frugal life. My folks had, both of them, Dutch descent. Grandparents, the whole set of them, had come over from the Netherlands prior to 1900. My dad was World War I vet and didn't serve very long. He had a heart murmur, and they sent him home. Both coming out of Depression, 1900 depressions. My mother was a cigar maker, $10 a week. And so the money was always very valuable thing to us. I saved newspapers and magazines. I got 10 bucks 100 pounds for newspapers and 15 bucks for 100 pounds of magazines. Take them to Casey the junk man and came back real big smile on my face.
That could buy a lot of candy in those years. Do you remember having some ambitions back then, thinking, hey, when I grow up, this is what I want to do with my life?
Not really. Took an architecture class in high school, and I thought I'd become an architect. There was never a question whether or not I would go to school after high school. I was going to go. Both my parents were 8th grade graduates, and they were very education-oriented. So it was always, you were going to go to college.
You mentioned the Dutch heritage with your grandparents immigrating from the Netherlands. Did that mean you learned a little bit of that language growing up?
Not really. The only time I heard it is when my mother and father wanted to say something and went out of kids to know.
Came in handy. Well, and you mentioned school. You would have still been in high school when Pearl Harbor happened.
Pearl Harbor, yeah.
Do you remember how you heard about that?
I'd gone to a youth group at church. It was Sunday afternoon. I came home and opened up the door to go in the house. My mother says, "There's a war on. There's war. We were attacked." And so that's the way I learned of it.
Did it register for you, or was it kind of
not
hard to
really,
understand?
Not really, not really. But she gave me an awful funny look because she knew I would be in it sooner or later. She had gone through World War I, of course.
Yeah.
Prior to 1941, a lot of guys coming out of high school went into the Army to get the National Guard pay. And so they were activated. 32nd Infantry Division was activated quite early. So it was, the war was a very real thing. My mother had a pail and sand in the attic to put out a fire bomb.
Wow.
Certain men on the street were fire wardens and that sort of thing. So you realize there was a war on.
And when you say the guys who had signed up for the National Guard were activated, so would those have been some of the guys ahead of you in school that you had known growing up or seen around
my
town?
My cousin was one of those. The 32nd Division, 126th Infantry Regiment, was the one in Grand Rapids. And so some of those were in school with me. You had to be 18 to get into it. You know, you were very aware that there was a war on. There was rationing. Sugar was rationed. Tires were rationed. Mm-hmm. Gasoline was rationed.
So how soon was it that you started thinking, hey, when I'm old enough, maybe I'm going to get involved in this?
When in high school, 12th grade, as I said, I went to the JC, local JC, and found this program, ASTP. And so this was an opportunity to get an education and be in the Army both.
You're only 17 years old, though.
Yes.
How'd your mother feel about that?
Well, she would encourage it. I had a very patriotic mother. There wasn't a, growing up, I can't remember a parade that we missed. And I still see her as a little boy. I see her when I go to a parade. You know, I stiffen up when the flag goes by, and it just happens. That's the way I was taught.
So ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program, this was happening all over the country. And what was it about that program that attracted you? What were they promising you? As a result,
an education.
So you enlist, and you're going to get a college education before you ever fight.
Yes.
That was the deal.
That was the deal.
So where'd they send you?
Up to Northern Michigan, Michigan Tech. And we had our first semester up there, and it was just a little bit advanced high school, first freshman JC kind of the programs. So that was the course. We began to get physically fit. You had a daily exercise program. You had a three-mile run every Friday morning. And so you began to do, physically, you began to get in shape.
Did it ever occur to you that whatever was happening in the war could cut this short? Was that even a thought in your mind?
No.
You're thinking, hey, I'm going to be in school for the next few years.
Yeah.
But how long were you in school till they changed the deal on you?
Well, I got the first semester in, and then they changed the deal in the middle of our basic training program.
And so after a semester of basic engineering studies up there at Michigan Tech, they send you all the way down to Fort Benning, Georgia.
Yes.
And this is the basic training, but you're still thinking, okay, after basic training, I'm going back to school.
Yeah.
So what was that basic training like?
More physical fitness and then Army tactics. Fort Benning is the infantry school, so you learned all of the how to parade, salute, and all that sort of stuff, and the regimen of charges and corporals and all that sort of thing. We're going to tell you what to do.
Was any of that challenging for you?
Not really.
Your parents had already toughened you up, huh?
You just said yes or no, sir.
Uh-huh. You're at Fort Benning, and you find out, okay, I don't get to go back to school. How did they break that news to you, and how did you feel about it?
Not particularly upset.
No?
No, no. You're a young kid, and we got weekly lectures from young lieutenants on the shape of the war and what was going on. Mm. And you can remember how the Russians fell back and the Germans took ground is all they got, and the Russians kept going back and back. No, I didn't. I can't remember anything about the Japan at that point in time. I don't think they were that active to begin with. But
basically, you're still a teenager, and all of a sudden, you go from being in school for a few years to finding out, hey, they need bodies in the war, and I'm going to be heading overseas pretty soon. And you were fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're invincible at 18.
We would find out, I'm sure. And you mentioned your cousin, who had been called up immediately after Pearl Harbor. Did you have an awareness of what he was doing or how he was doing overseas?
Yes, because as I said, they put him right in the 126th Infantry, and they immediately went to Australia, and then they became involved in New Guinea and that sort of thing. And kids I went to school with, and pretty soon some of them were dying. Mm. And that family lost two already. That family lost one. Every other house that had somebody in the service had a little flag in the service flag, a little blue star.
Right.
Gold star was death, silver star was captured or missing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you would go to church, the church had a big flag in front of it with all the kids that were in the service. And then every once in a while, a gold star, silver star would appear in that flag. So you were very, very well aware what was happening.
Well, and that had to be sobering. These are guys that you grew up with, you knew. And...
Yeah.
Not much older than you, and they're gone.
No, they're gone.
So now you know this is real, and you're going to be involved. And where'd they send you from Fort Benning?
Louisiana, and Camp Livingston, Louisiana, which is now a state park, I think. But it was a swamp then. And you learned all about chiggers and that sort of stuff.
I wonder how many of our listeners know about chiggers. If they've never been in the South, they probably don't.
Probably don't.
Did you learn the hard way?
You had tick bites and chiggers, yeah. Yeah. You had the ointment, the spray or the insect repellent. And the green one always got insect repellent. You'd tell him to put it on the fly of his pants, and it was very, very stinging. And You sweat for 3 days.
That's cruel.
Well, when you did it to a sergeant, you had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, my goodness. So it sounds like everything you've described so far, it almost sounds like an adventure for you, that you were enjoying this.
You're invincible at that age.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, looking back at it. Yeah, it was fun. I had a good time.
So you didn't get yourself in any trouble then?
No, no.
Was that because you didn't get caught or you didn't try hard enough?
Didn't get caught.
Uh-huh. Anything you want to fess up to now, all these years later?
No, not really.
And as you're training and going through these different spots, did you start to form some relationships and bonds with some of these other young men?
Yeah. One young man and I enlisted together. We met on the road to Detroit when we had to enlist. His name was Ralph Cole, K-O-L-L. I was K-O-N.
Ah.
And so the two of us stayed together through our entire Army experience, all the way to being discharged, and came home on the train together.
How about that?
Every time I was on KP, he was on KP. We got our furloughs together. We got our promotions pretty much close together.
So you're in Camp Livingston, enjoying the swamp.
Enjoying the swamp. You then get shipped to California.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was 30 days aboard a ship off San Diego. We went on and, you know, climbing up and down the nets on the side of the ship and then into the little boats. And then Umbriago when you hit the shore.
Now explain that for us. I don't know if our listeners know what you're talking about when you say that. What was the origin of this new declaration when you're coming off the landing craft?
We had an Italian major of the battalion, and he was enamored with Jimmy Durante.
Uh-huh.
And he knew that the paratroopers yelled Geronimo when they jumped out of their plane, so the guys on the ground had to yell Umbriago to make up for it when you hit the beach.
That's funny.
Then it came, you know, you took that training took a month or so more. And then several different camps coming up the Oregon coast. And each one that had a pier, they would regularly jump us off and we'd swim to shore off the end of the pier. Just so that everybody knew swimming. You had a life preserver.
So you're doing all this practice, and I'm sure in the back of your mind you're thinking, boy, I'm going to have to do this for real at some point.
Yeah, but you never dwelled on that.
All right.
You don't dwell on that sort of thing.
When did you find out you were heading overseas?
December of 44.
So this is right about when the Battle of the Bulge is happening.
Battle of the Bulge, and Eisenhower needed one more division, and so we were supposed to hit Okinawa from California. That's why we had that amphibious training. Well, uh-huh. Eisenhower needed one more division. It's really an amazing thing. They moved 15,000 people between like Christmas and by the 6th of January, we were aboard a ship in Boston going over to Europe.
Wow. You know, I've talked to other guys from the 86th. I don't know if I've ever caught on to that distinction before. But now with hindsight, you know what happened at Okinawa. You know how many lives were lost.
Yeah.
And you guys would have been making that landing is
we
what you're saying.
We would have made that landing. We were trained for it.
I'm not saying it was a picnic where you ended up, but I wonder what would have happened to Bill Koning if you had to go to Okinawa.
No idea.
Yeah. So you get this other curveball, and they take you from California over to Boston, and now you're heading over to Europe.
Yes.
What was that journey across the Atlantic like for you?
For a land lover, you look at out of that water, and you think about submarines, and the Germans had a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you were in convoy, but the thought did go through your head that they, you know, if they sunk that ship.
Mm-hmm.
It was cold. It was January. You did your exercise out on the deck. It was cold out there. I can remember that. Landed in Le Havre. We were in tents in France for about 6 weeks. That would be January through February, I think. It was cold, real cold. You had every piece of clothing on inside your little barracks bag and everything else. But, we were living in tents.
Colder than Grand Rapids?
Oh, yeah. It was cold in France.
And I guess I should have you explain. All of you've mentioned anyway is the 86th Infantry Division. But that's a whole lot of guys, and you've got regiments and battalions and companies. What was your specific duty as you understood it?
I was the so-called first scout in the 3rd Squad of the 2nd Platoon of I Company of the 341st Regiment and 86th Infantry Division.
Uh-huh.
And so as first scouts, you're supposed to see them before they see you.
Yeah, and that's one of the most precarious positions anyone could have in your whole division.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, first scout, yeah. You are the tip of the spear in that scenario.
But landing in Le Havre and cold, we went to a bar on the Rhine River, and the whole group was, they just walk into these places and you take over. And so this bar had a beautiful patio out looking over the Rhine. There was a normal infantry squad had maybe, was supposed to be 12. We had maybe 10, 9 guys. Look out and see Germans on the other side, very small things going past on bicycles once in a while. And so we were just sitting there. And along about the 1st of April was Easter. And they asked for volunteers to a patrol to go across the Rhine River and pick up a person, find somebody that knew what outfit was over there. Now, why they had to know the name of the German outfit, I don't know. But we were supposed to get a German prisoner and bring him back with us.
That sounds like a pretty mundane mission. No big deal. And we're going to hear Bill's memories from that mission, which almost claimed his life, when we come back. You can also read about that Easter Sunday patrol in the book One Soldier's War by Ralph Cole, that buddy from Grand Rapids that Bill met on the train to Detroit and stayed close to throughout the war. I have that book linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.